be wrong on this, but looking back, I felt, because I'm reading it in, but because I felt to myself that what was happening there was a threat to me.
What was happening in Vietnam?
No, what was happening with the letter was a threat.
Okay.
And in a kind of way, because I had, you know, been there for a year, and I wanted to stay there for 2 years. And yet the dynamics of the letter was to sign this and resign, essentially, to say I can't do this anymore. And
now, there's no compromise in that.
Yeah, and so in a kind of way...
In that letter I meant.
Yeah, and in a kind of way, and I haven't read, you know, I haven't read the letter since 1967, probably, or whatever. But and so I remember feeling, in a kind of way, I remember feeling that I was in a discussion. I don't know if Don asked me if I was going to resign or what I planned to do, and I said, I don't want to resign. And I felt I was letting Don loose down in some way.
Why not resigning?
By not resigning.
Uh-huh.
Or that there were two kinds of people involved in that at the time, and then there were sort of the purists who felt that they had to resign, and then some of us who would sort of stay on. But I think that out of that dynamic came a deeper sense, and it began to be articulated, because someone must have picked up the question of do you resign or don't you resign.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that Don and a couple of the other people were saying, at one point they said, we don't want people to resign. We feel that as the directors, or as director, we must resign, but we want you to stay on. And that sort of allowed us to sign and feel somehow that we could continue our mission.
What were the rationales that they had for you, your continuing to stay?
Well, because that there was, for the very practical things, that there is, that we needed to be witnesses. We needed to be witnesses to what was going on there. Who else is going to tell the story?
Right.
And who else is going to continue to maintain the, you know, because the thing that, you know, this famous quote in Time magazine, and I forgot who said it, but it was the most famous quote, you know, were band-aids on the genocide that was going on here. And I don't remember who said it, but it was someone who said it at that time. And what, you know, so that, so we came to understand that we were being used to present a wholesome good image when it was really covering a deeper evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurt a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it made us feel, and it made us feel that we were complicit when we didn't want to feel complicit, because integrity for us meant a lot. Then,
but by, just to throw in something, but by staying for the purpose of witnessing,
right,
and for sending information back to Don and to Ronk and to,
right,
Stolzfus, and I forget the Myers,
right,
who had resigned and who would go throughout the country,
right,
you're sort of giving up the notion that you can do anything.
Right. I think so.
There's a real recognition that...
It was at that time that... I think it was that time that I saw myself and my role evolving. And, you know, I'm a journalist today, and I think that I could possibly trace back my profession to the mission that came out of the letter. And that circumstance, that now you are not here now to just do the good. You are here to be witnesses to the situation and then to send word back. And but that was also, but that was not just a commission from that moment. It was a commission out of the experience that I had repeatedly. I used to talk to the Vietnamese refugees.
Yeah.
I the kinds of questions that I was facing there, I would just put to the Vietnamese that I was working with. Or, working is a pretty strange word, that I was visiting or living with or seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Interacting with, yeah. And I would say, do you think that I should stay, or do you think, and to every single one of them. In fact, I remember even the letter was translated into Vietnamese, and I remember showing them the letter, and there was a group of about 12 men, as a matter of fact, and they read the letter.
Who translated?
I don't know, but it was translated into Vietnamese. You'd have to ask, but I had a copy in Vietnamese. I'm quite, yeah. It was, and
now I heard it had been, and it just occurred to me, who
I don't
did
know.
It?
Yeah. I don't know. It was translated into Vietnamese, and I showed it to some people in there, and I told them that I had signed this letter, and that, what should I do? And to the person, every single one of them said, your work is to tell the American people what's going on here. You must tell the American people what's going on here. You must tell them that what we want more than anything else is peace. And you must tell them what's going on. And because I know this. I mean, one of the most certain things that I know is that the Vietnamese people thought that the American people were good.
Mm-hmm.
Being an American, I knew that they were naive in a sense of how good we were, because there were some bad dudes in America and some people who were very racist and prejudiced but the Vietnamese people, either because of propaganda or because of culture, every single time that you would ask them what do you think of the American people, they would say the American people are good people, but they don't know what's happening to us. And if they knew what was happening to us, they would stop their policymakers. They isolated the evilness of the war in the policymakers of the American people. And Johnson and Johnson and the military, and I think when I had to ask myself why this was, I came to the conclusion that they were reading their own experience into the circumstance, because they saw themselves as divorced from their own government, and they saw their government as, because most of these Vietnamese are basic anarchists, or they don't believe in central government, but they
and to play devil's advocate, they were not connected with the Viet Cong.
Which ones?
The ones you were talking to.
Oh,
giving you this advice.
Yeah, probably.
They probably were.
Probably were.
Okay.
I think there wasn't. Everyone was connected to the Viet Cong. It's really too easy to say that there's. It's not one of the things that is a wrong impression is that you have two camps of people.
Right.
And these people are on this side, and these people are on this side. It was never quite like that. It was much more like this. And everyone had some relatives who were Viet Cong and some who were not, and some who had an uncle and some, I mean, they were there. The tangledness of all of this.
Yeah, okay, so there wouldn't be two different hands, but they would be entangled fingers. But the people you were talking to were refugees, right?
Yeah, but they were refugees of, they were refugees, they were, again, I come back to, I think, a deeper sense that this was a war between the cities and the countryside, and these were countryside people.
Yeah, there were countryside people. Refugees weren't high up in a structure for the Viet Cong.
No.
So these would be more like average cadres who had sympathies and ties all over the place.
If they were cadres at all, I don't know, they were farmers. These were farmers. And if they were cadres, they were cadres. If they were not, I mean, those are words that we put on things.
I'm asking you these questions
for
a reason, and that is that the opposite side would say, well, these are communist agents who are using this shy, naive American to tell him to go and weaken the resolve of the American people, otherwise we could have won.
No, because
I have to ask
that.
Yeah,
I know, I understand that. But it was universal.
Yeah.
I mean, you could ask, in isolation, you could go and ask a 78-year-old man who is not connected to no one. You could ask a 15-year-old boy connected to no one. You could ask a 30-year-old mother connected to no one in isolation, never talked to another person. And you say, what is your impression of the American people or what's going on here? And they'll say, the American people are good people, but the American government is misguided, and the policy is because the American people don't know what's going on here. And if the American people knew what was going on here, they would not allow it to happen.
Yeah.
And so that it was pervasive. It was everywhere. That's what they thought. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, now maybe really educated people who have international ties, either from commerce or education or institutions, don't think that way. But the uneducated, unconnected person thinks that way in Vietnam. And I think, how did that get to be that everyone thought that way? And I think it was because there was such a gap in Vietnamese society between government and ordinary life, common folk. There was such an enormous gap that they saw that the ordinary folk are okay, they're great, they have no problem, they can get along, they can find a way, they've done it for centuries. The problem is that government is entering into their life, drafting their sons, or making alliances and bringing over Americans, or ripping off the rice, or whatever it is that government does. Government did nothing for them.
Just breaks down the hedge that just protects the village.
It just crushes life in the village, and the village life makes the village life works. But when the government enters, it ruins everything. And when it enters in a heavy-handed way, it's very, very dangerous, and kills. So I think that they thought that our government was the same way. So I should be the person who tells the American people what's going on so that the American government would stop. So they have a very sophisticated view and a very idealistic view of democracy.
There's no one outside right now, but I saw a couple little girls kind of look at the house and go like that, and walk on. I thought that was so cute.
I know. And so we have this... And you know, so it's curious that they believed in democracy, and in their sense that American democracy must work. In my sense, was it certainly doesn't. And so anyhow, so it was not only Don Luce who was counseling us to stay, and Don Ronk. It was the Vietnamese people who were telling me stay, stay. You belong here because you know, you understand, you can tell your people. First of all, I understood, they thought, because I spoke the language and I saw the pain and I felt it and I empathized with it. And secondly, because I had enough power and prestige by just being an American that I could get the message to someone important who cared and made a difference. And so I was their best hope.
Yeah, so they were sort of reaching out for you. So that hope, and they were also, this is kind of interesting, it relates back to the French Revolution. Some historians have said that the French Revolution really happened when the people realized that it wasn't just the evil ministers around the king, but the king ordered it too. So therefore we have to overthrow everybody. You know, so they might have been holding on to the faith that really if the people of the United States could only influence the government.
Yes.
That they're good, you know, and that, because otherwise what do you have to... to think that they're all evil, they're all out to get us, and there is no hope.
Well, there is no, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, the Viet Cong, I think the Viet Cong were working for the same end. And I think the Viet Cong were the whole, what I didn't understand and early on, but I understood it slowly, that the degree that this was a political war, because the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were clearly fighting a war that was that the Viet Cong wanted to make it painful enough so that it would be too painful to stay but they were fighting a war that they figured they could win in 10 or 15 years and it just I could never understand that. I could not understand how you can fight a war and be committed to a war for 10 or 15 years or 20 years or 30 years until I realized that a generation for the Vietnamese is not much. It's just a generation. I mean, we only have to fight a generation. We might have to fight two generations. I mean, it's a different way of thinking. And we think, gosh, you know, are we going to have to fight this another year,
mm-hmm.
another 2 years?
We want people out of Bosnia by March.
Yes. And they, it's not a construct that's artificial. It is not something that they make an effort to do,
mm-hmm.
to say, boy, we're going to have to sacrifice for an entire generation. Mm-hmm. That's not it. You're missing it if you think that's it. A generation is just the natural thing that you do. And if you have to do it for a generation or two or three, that's okay. We've done it before. We might have to do it, you know, we had to do it in the past for six generations. So that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finally get into that mindset and understand that mindset, you understand how the war is lost and that they won. I mean, they won. It's all they're doing is they're trying to just reclaim the country. And, you know, I don't need to get into all the cultural things, but it became very, very clear to me from studying Vietnamese history. I studied when I was a senior at Stanford, studied Vietnamese history. And then when I got to Vietnam and I reconfirmed by my conversations with Vietnamese there that their Vietnamese history is an oral history and that all of their heroes were people who drove out foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
And that they defined themselves, the words Vietnam are the people to the south, they defined themselves as those people who are not, and they are not Chinese, they are not French, they are not Americans, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, this war is over. There's no, and the thing that really hurt the most in a kind of way is when you've come to the understanding that the Americans are going to continue this war when it's already lost, and what they're only going to do is prolong the suffering and the killing for whatever ends, to save face. We always talked about the Vietnamese had to save face. Bullshit.
Who was saving face?
It was the
the light at the end of the tunnel is saving face.
The Americans were saving the face and killing people to do it.
We're going to pause again.
The point where...
Yeah.
We got to the point where I'm there in Vietnam and sending back stuff to Don Luce.
And I wanted to ask about his transformation.
Oops.
What we were saying before we began the tape about Don's transformation, because you noticed how he was pretty much the same person that he might have been before you knew him for a long time. And then there was, I think you said, an 18-month period.
Right.
In which he changed very fundamentally in
right.
his political views and actions.
Well, I think it's there. You know, there's the change was very intense in '66 and '67, and it was amazing. I mean, it was just truly amazing because I can remember very early arguing with Don about the war.
Uh huh.
And I mean, just in the first months that I was there, in which he was not supportive of the war, but sort of going along with us as you know, doing the good work, and
uh-huh.
because that's what we were there to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember communicating with him and talking about the refugees, and he was always very open and. And I think that he was getting information from all over the country that things were changing. And this was not sweet potatoes in the highlands.
Sugar baby watermelons.
Sugar baby watermelons. That, it was, that it had changed.
Uh-huh.
And I just think that there was a period of about a year and a half in which there was an enormous change in Don Luce. And I was just shocked at how much change there was. And then the thing that continued to impress me was the fact that there was a kind of growth in commitment and a politicization that began with Vietnam, and it sort of extended out into all kinds of other issues. And then in the early 70s, of course, into the whole area of gay rights. And that was, it was just like a maturing of an educational process that was very, very interesting. And you know, Don remains highly politicized, but also very humane and decent. And you know, there are three men that I look to that are similar in that way. And I think, you know, I think Dwight Clark, if you know Dwight Clark, Dwight Clark is the founder of VIA, Volunteers in Asia, VIA, West Coast Stanford Group, and then Don Luce, and then Ralph Nader. I mean, people are sort of, and I don't know, I've never met Ralph Nader, but what Ralph Nader speaks to me of is a very sophisticated kind of political viewpoint, and a man of such integrity that you can't trip him up. He's just, they try as much as they want, but he's just got too much integrity for them. There's no chinks in that armor. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Don Luce, it represents that same kind of integrity to me.
Yeah. And you said that you were somewhat helpful in that transformation, or that you were a part of it in a sense.
I can only Don could tell you that, and I can't say, but I do know that I would be talking to him about the refugee thing, and he would listen, and mm-hmm. I think that the way he was responding, and the way, you know, when he said Kennedy was coming, and then Kennedy wanted to talk to me about the refugee situation, and mm-hmm. and I could, you know, I could see that Don's own thoughts and his own thinking was changing. Don has the great strength of being able to learn and to ask questions about himself, and so I think that was something that was. And I think that other people, I mean, a lot of other people, I think Don Ronk, in his own way, were very, very sophisticated human being, you know, mm-hmm. deep person. Gene Stoltzfus became politicized. And Gene, each one of them coming from a different way, you know, the sort of Vermontan farmer, the Indiana, what is it, Mennonite, or... Don is sort of the you know, Don is just a worldly kind of cynic somehow, but a beautiful person. And they, because I was outside of those conversations, and I fed into them from the outskirts, from uh-huh. Tuiwa. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how that developed, except I would just come in at key moments, as it turned out. I can't tell you what reason it was that Don asked me to accompany him, because he could have asked anyone, and he asked me to accompany him to deliver the letter to Ambassador Bunker. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it could have been Gene Stoltzfus or someone, but mm-hmm. For some reason he asked me, and I think that I represented maybe the Vietnamese refugee experience.
Pause again. Okay, all right.
So that was, so then we went, and I remember when Ambassador Bunker came into the room, and he was, you know, he's always very stiff and firm, and I think he sat down with an aide, and we talked a little bit about the policies, and Don was telling him what he thought. And I think he just handed him the letter. I don't remember if Bunker read it there at that time or not. But I'd like to, at some point, sit down and talk to Don about his own recollections of that time. That's because I don't have detailed memories of you know what, how it developed. But I just remember it was a kind of solemn experience. You knew that it was important.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't casual by any means. This represented a break, a very serious break of ranks.
Mm-hmm.
And if Bunker saw us as part of the team, it was the first major breaking apart of the team. And I think that they recognized that.
Mm-hmm. For what it was, even though it was a small agency.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was not, because I'm sure that Bunker looked upon us as USAID, and not as, I know, as I, we're...
Oh, not as IBS.
Yeah,
okay.
See, and so, as we're a subdivision of it, but, it, and so I think that, I think it was a serious threat.
Mm-hmm.
Far beyond the numbers involved.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. And also the because he knew that this was going to be, you know, it'll get into the press and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think I have explained the Vietnam experience, certainly the most formative experience in my life. To this day, I am editor of the National Catholic Reporter, and I act out of the energies unleashed in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There is an absolute direct line from Vietnam to my work at this time in my life. It was like the Vietnam exploded me and set me on a course that I've tried to stay on. It's not like I can get off of it. It's just like it's too deep and too formative. The suffering, the militarism, the arrogance of power, the deceit, the beauty of another culture, the deep sense of shared humanity,
mm-hmm.
The fragileness of life, all of these very, very profoundly affected me and the way I look at life. And as I left Vietnam and finally got into journalism at the Detroit Free Press, I found myself writing about the jails. And then from there I was going into, I went to the Washington Star and I was going up the journalistic career ladder, and I found myself being taken away from the values and commitments that were very, very deep inside of me. And I could have stayed in journalism at the, and I was at age 33, 34, I was becoming a successful editor in Washington, D.C. And my career was very, very bright from that point of view, but I felt myself becoming more distant from the administrative aspects, the layers of bureaucracy, and the corporate nature of things was just numbing or blocking what it was that was deeper within me. And so when this job as editor of the National Catholic Reporter opened up in 1980, it allowed me to return to my mission.
Mm-hmm.
And my mission, I think, is my deepest mission is bringing, allowing the voiceless to have voices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm beyond the thought that I can bring justice, but I know that the commitment must be to justice, and the commitment must be to mercy, and the commitment must be to compassion and forgiveness, and the commitment above all has to be for giving a voice to those people who would otherwise not have voices. And so when the Vietnamese were saying, go back and tell your people,
it started from there.
It started from there. It's ringing in my head today. You know?
Uh-huh.
If I'm writing about the homeless or the refugees or women in the church or gays and lesbians,
uh-huh.
or, you know, the multitude of issues which we cover come from my deep perspective that that the poor and the powerless and the vulnerable and the weak above all need to be heard. And if we're not giving them voices, then we're not doing our jobs.
But when, to skip ahead but back to Tet Offensive,
yeah.
You were talking about that just a wee bit, and I pulled you back to the 67 letter.
Right.
But it's not really that many months. Much.
I was in Saigon with Kim Winokur. I don't know where Kim Winokur is today. He moved to Hawaii, married a Vietnamese, and I haven't been in touch with him for 15 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Someday I'd like to be in touch with him again. And Kim and I were in Saigon in the Central Market, and I remember being in the Central Market the day before Tet and seeing a balloon go flying up inside the Central Market with a Viet Cong flag on it. And I said, whoa!
That's pretty gutsy.
Yeah. I said, something's going on here. And then on Tet, or the eve of Tet, I was invited to a home of a Vietnamese and friend, and we had dinner together and left at about 10. And then I guess I went back to IVS, and then about 11 o'clock or midnight or so, it was all hell broke loose, and and I was in the IVS house in out by Tan Son Nhut, and just got caught out there, and the next day, we marched in with a whole line of refugees coming down Le Van Zuyet, hundreds if not thousands of refugees coming down to the central part of the city for protection, and then we ended up in a apartment building in for about a week, I think, downtown Saigon, and on the roof, and with fighting going on in the streets below us. I mean, real fighting.
Yeah.
Just, and I remember, I think, unless I'm getting it confused, I think that General Westmoreland was back in the United States at that time, because I remember listening to the Saigon radio and the armed forces, and I think he was talking to Congress and talking about the way the Saigon was secure,
mm-hmm.
and everything was back under control, and we were laying on the roof with gunfire all around us,
mm-hmm.
and I'm saying,
what's this control?
Yeah, I mean we couldn't leave the building. Because
yeah.
there was fighting all over the streets and around
us.
And somehow he was trying to assure the nation that everything was, it was a ridiculous thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tet experience made it much, much more difficult, impossible,
mm-hmm.
for us to leave the cities. I mean, at that point, the work of even getting into the countryside or going around, pretending to be able to go around became impossible. It was just, everything came to a halt. Everything came to a halt. And
you mean more than just a couple of days?
Oh, I'm talking about 2 or 3 months.
Okay. I mean,
there was just, anyone who was doing anything at any place was just, you stopped. You know, there was no one to go to. I went back to Tuiwa, and my house that was riddled with bullets.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying that they came to shoot me or anything like that. I'm saying that there was fighting going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This was just stray bullets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not even stray. There was just, they were fighting in the streets right in front of them. And I was very fortunate not to be caught in Tuiwa,
uh-huh.
Because Tuiwa was overrun,
uh-huh.
largely overrun. And I know other people were caught, like in Tue and Hoi An and some other places. They were really caught. And they had to hide for days. I'm glad that I didn't have to suffer through that experience.
Oh, yeah.
I was in Saigon. It was scary enough, but I wasn't all alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was with other Americans. And but the work, our work ended, and so I think from the Tet Offensive on, it was just a gradual winding down of our presence until I think. It was March or April or so, or May, or that I left Vietnam and came back.
Would that have been a little bit early?
I think I came back a month or two early.
Okay.
Because there was just nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I wanted to get back in time for the June, I think it was the Republican, or I went to both Democratic and Republican conventions.
I just turned this back on
because yes.
I wanted to say that I got here at 3:00. It's already 5:25. Your life is berserko.
Yeah.
And I think that we're already 25 minutes beyond what you were planning for me, and you've got all these other things. So we better wrap up fairly quick.
Okay.
You. And I hope that we might be able to email back and forth if there are follow-ups
sort of
questions. In a
how long is your project going to continue? I mean, would you see this over the next 6 months, over the next 3 months, over the next 2 weeks? Or
well, the interviewing, I'll be back in Georgia in September 9th.
Uh-huh.
But we're going to continue to do interviews in the Southeast in the fall when the weather's better.
Mm-hmm.
Mark's going to be going up to Tennessee and North Carolina. I'll be going down to Florida, a few other places. Mark might be going out to Texas, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as taking all the tapes and
right.
you going through them, it's
sure.
going to be long.
I'm glad it is. I'm honored to be part of it, and I hope that it was helpful.
Yeah. I do have one final kind of
sure.
question. Some of the final questions I normally do are, how did it affect your life? And you've already said that on your own.
To say nothing about the fact that I, in January 71, I married a Vietnamese. And I mean, I want to tell you one thing.
You met there?
Yeah, we met there. Because here's something that I think I've come to understand. Vietnam, as important, it's, Vietnam was a double-edged sword.
Uh-huh.
An experience that is that deep, and is so conditioning, can make it very, very difficult to get beyond.
Okay.
In other words, it captures you.
Mm-hmm.
It scars you. I mean, it certainly captures you. For many of the military, it scarred them very,
very
deeply.
Sure.
It didn't have to work with the scars as much as it had to work with the embrace.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that many other people have found their lives less meaningful.
Since.
Uh-huh. I couldn't tell you the names of any of them, but I know that that experience happens.
I know the phenomenon, the RPCV group, the Return Peace Corps Volunteers uh-huh. group. I don't go to the reunions
yeah.
because it's just nostalgia out the wazoo.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't take it. It's too saccharine. It's too caught up in the past. It's
mm-hmm.
too nostalgic.
And you know,
I just want to scream.
I'll tell you a couple things there, but I have been blessed, and I didn't plan it, and it just happened, but I've been blessed because I was able to leave Vietnam and not leave Vietnam at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to leave Vietnam and bring Vietnam home with me. It wasn't like I said, now what do I really need to do to stay healthy? But by marrying a Vietnamese, I continue to live in the Vietnamese presence, and not in the Vietnamese past. And the Vietnamese presence is different. I'm not caught in 1967 or 8. I'm in 1996, and so the Vietnam today is more than it's life coming out of death, and the Olympics is and I didn't plan to give birth to the first Vietnamese gold medalist, but Juan and I have 3 children. So, it's really special. And it's not the past, and it's the present. And yet we're doing something, and out of Vietnam has come love and healing and life. And it's a blessing. And so the blessings of Vietnam continue today.
And Catherine can drag you into the future and hold you in this present.
And to have this happen, it's too much. I mean,
no,
I don't, very
supposed to happen like this.
Very few people, because they don't understand it, but I mean, very, very few people. The press is not very deep. One or two people have caught it and understand it. But Catherine is the first Vietnamese American Olympian. What does that say about what's possible? What does that say, you know, those rings, those Olympic rings? We go through this whole thing and it's USA, USA. And In a way that all helps with my own healing, because the flag, I went through 20 years and I couldn't sing the national anthem. I could barely stand up. Not after seeing the American flag painted on those jet fighter bombers. It was, it took a long, long time of a reorientation of the symbols of America for me to be able to to stand and sing or listen to the national anthem. And so this is all part of a healing process. And to have the Olympic experience, which is really the family, the human family competing nonviolently, somehow has just been too much.
Too Sarah.
So anyhow, the where is it going? I don't know, but there's real life, and it's great, it's terrific.
Yeah, the only back to the past. The only question I had, I was thinking when I got out, you know, the address to give you there. Well, first of all, I hope that he wasn't one of those who had moved and. Might be a wrong address. I'll have to check when I get home. But I was going through the thing, and I came to Whitfield, who took over after
Dan
Don.
Whitfield, yeah.
Yeah. And I was wondering what your impressions of him were as his style in holding the organization together.
Right. I was pretty suspicious of Dan Whitfield. And it was not fair to be suspicious, because I didn't know the person.
Right.
And I had no reason to be, I guess I figured, I was saying to myself, we're very judgmental. I mean, it's being 22 22 years old. You're very judgmental and you're very caught up in things. And so I didn't work with Dan Whitfield long enough. I felt that the experiences I've had with him were that he was a caring person who was trying to do the very best he could in very, very difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that he'd never, he certainly, not to my knowledge, did he ever undermine anything that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of Gittleson's death, I think that he was doing everything he could to find out what was going on and responding in the most humane possible way. And yet, I didn't have a close working relationship with him. I didn't have the bonds that I had with Don Luce. And again, it was only like a short period. I think it was relatively, you know, it was like after the Tet Offensive, I couldn't tell you what was going on. It was so.
Right. So you really only had from whenever he was appointed in October, probably, or at least end of September until Tet.
Right.
Which is almost nothing to really get to know a new person.
Yeah, and it's not, so I couldn't, you know, I haven't thought much of him, and just because it hasn't come across, and even when you mentioned the name, I realized that there was a few, you know, at least a few months where I was working with him, but I don't have a strong impression.
Mm-hmm.
I have no, you know, I have no negative reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I think that he represented more of the, you know, the institutional, let's get on with it, than Don. And but I felt, yeah, I guess I couldn't say anything any more than that.
Okay, because I did ask Don about him,
mm-hmm.
and then I just saw him in Carbondale a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Don has a great deal of nice things to say about
mm-hmm.
him, you know, that he in fact did keep things moving,
mm-hmm.
you know, that he did try to get healing,
mm-hmm.
and he did take care of the volunteers as best he could during Tet,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. But I was only thinking that, you know, I was playing devil's advocate for him. Maybe
right.
he was brought in to pacify the troops
mm-hmm.
in the ranks and
yeah.
get him back to the field and stop this foolishness. And,
mm-hmm.
and Don said,
no.
He wasn't at all.
Yeah, he was not, that was not my impression. I mean,
no.
he was dealt a very, very difficult hand.
Oh, yeah.
And
not squarely, too, because he wasn't told about how despondent many of the volunteers were
mm-hmm.
and how low the morale really was.
I don't know if you remember, now, I think that's right that you say that, because I think there was a period of time in which he was coming to a new insight into how low the morale was.
Yeah, he said he went from volunteer to volunteer. He definitely, you know, hell bent to see absolutely everyone up front.
Yeah,
to talk to them and to
mm-hmm.
talk it out over and over again. He said to me the other day, kind of like when you do these interviews, everyone you see, you go through the same questions.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I thought about him.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get that last question in, and it's already now getting on towards 26.
Mm-hmm.
I have some people to call too.
Okay.
So
I got a call from here.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to ask if I could.
Okay.
Your callers can certainly. Wait and call back.
Yes, sure.
We've had enough of them.
But
so I'll close this off for now. What in your